Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today we have a new episode of Postscript, a series of conversations that Lily Gorin and I have created that allow authors to connect their scholarship to contemporary political events. Today's Postscript explores the intellectual and political significance of Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to Congress and to run for the U.S. presidency. Her slogan was Unbought and Unbossed, and she fought for the working class women against war throughout her long career. She defined empowerment in the second half of the 20th century. In order to explore Chisholm's political and intellectual legacy, I'm delighted to welcome two accomplished scholars to the New Books Network. Dr. Anastasia Curwood is an associate professor of history at the University of Kentucky and the director of African American and Africana Studies in the University of Kentucky's College of Arts and Sciences. She's held prestigious fellowships from the Ford Foundation, Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, and the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference at Emory University. Dr. Curwood's scholarship focuses on the interface between private life and historical context for Black Americans in the 20th century. In particular, she studies the workings of gender in African American social, cultural, intellectual, and political history. Her first book, Stormy Weather, Middle-Class African-American Marriages Between the Two World Wars, published by the University of North Carolina Press, explored marriages between middle-class African-Americans in the era of the New Negro and the Great Depression. Dr. Curwood's current project is a critical biography of Shirley Chisholm entitled Aim High, Shirley Chisholm and Black Feminist Power Politics. Welcome to the podcast, Anastasia.
I'm delighted to be here.
So I'm also pleased to welcome Dr. Zynga Frazier, Assistant Professor of Africana Studies and the Women's and Gender Studies Program at Brooklyn College, CUNY, to the conversation. Dr. Frazier's scholarship focuses on African-American politics, Black women's history, and feminism. She has been researching and writing about Chisholm for almost a decade, and her master's thesis, Unbought and Unbossed, A Radical Political Ideology, received the Zora Neale Hurston Award from Columbia University. Dr. Frazier worked for the former Congressman Major R. Owens, the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, and served as the U.S. Policy Program Coordinator for the Women's Environmental and Development Organization. Dr. Frazier's forthcoming book is entitled Sister Insider, Sister Outsider, Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan, Black Women's Politics in the Post-Civil Rights Era. She serves as the director of the Shirley Chisholm Project at Brooklyn College, CUNY, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we have listeners from all over the world, so I'll really briefly introduce some of them to Shirley Chisholm. She's born in Brooklyn in 1924, but also spent time being raised by her grandmother in Barbados before returning to New York City to attend high school in Bedford-Stuyvesant. After college, she spent years working as teacher, director of nursery school, education consultant, and community activist. And in 1965, she was elected to the New York State Assembly. When she was elected by the people of Brooklyn's 12th Congressional District, she became the first African-American woman to serve in the House of Representatives. Her slogan, one that stuck with her throughout her life, was unbought and unbossed. In 1972, she ran to be the Democratic candidate for president and went to the Democratic convention with delegates, though Senator George McGovern was ultimately the candidate that unsuccessfully faced Richard Nixon. She said many times that she wanted the United States to live up to its promises. Chisholm said of herself that her achievement was having the audacity and nerve to run for the presidency of the United States. She said, quote, "I want history to remember me not as the first Black woman to have been elected to the Congress, not as the first Black woman to have made a bid for the presidency of the United States, but as a Black woman who lived in the 20th century and dared to be herself." The 50th anniversary of Chisholm's election to Congress in 2019, the TV series Mrs. America about the fight for the ERA, and the nomination of Senator Kamala Harris to be the vice presidential candidate for the Democratic Party have led more people to pay attention to Shirley Chisholm's legacy. But she wasn't someone highlighted by Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama when they ran for president. But yet the two of you and other scholars have been studying her for many years. Zynga, let's start off by you telling us a little bit about how did you come to write about Shirley Chisholm, and how did this connect to or even depart from the work that you had done previously?
Well, as a resident of Shirley Chisholm's district, I have a direct kind of connection to who she was, and my mother knew Chisholm coming up in New York City. And so there is, of course, a personal connection to Shirley Chisholm, as well as serving as a congressional staffer for the member who takes Shirley Chisholm's seat after she retires from political office in Congress, Major R. Owens. So I was, of course, quite familiar who she was. And the work that I did in undergraduate at Columbia University started really connecting the ways in which I felt she was disremembered being a resident from Brooklyn, as well as someone who studied African-American politics as a political science major. I felt that she was disremembered not only from a political science framework in terms of thinking about Black politics in the 1970s, but also how she was disremembered from also Black women's history and American history and political history. And so those are the kind of connections that connected me to Chisholm and her legacy and that work. And then the work that I'm doing now at the Shirley Chisholm Project at Brooklyn College. So there, in many ways, it's come full circle.
It's funny, my grandparents were from that district. I grew up in Queens with my father talking about Shirley Chisholm all the time, though he had not lived in Brooklyn for decades. As somebody who was heroic in her forcefulness for fighting for the working class, why do you think she sort of dropped out of focus from being so central to American politics?
I don't know if she's dropped out of focus in terms of the purviews of historians and political scientists. For those people who lived in those districts like yourself and your family members and my family members, she was always a part of the political discourse. And she's been a part of the political discourse for a number of people. However, I think in terms of the scholarship, there has been a lag and continues to be a lag at looking specifically at Black women as political agents, as well as strategists. And so the framing of African-American politics has always been in many ways masculinized. So when we think of the time period in which Shirley Chisholm comes to fruition and of her political organizing, as well as her policy initiatives, it's really framed in a kind of masculinized framing of Black men, Black mayors. There's continues to be focus on Black men in politics, but not necessarily Black women. And so because of that kind of racial and gendered intersectional inequality or inequity, there has been a way in which we disremember her from the kind of public discourse.
I like the term disremember. I think that works really, really well. And that explanation is helpful to me because I've never really understood it as a New Yorker. She was just kind of part of the scenery of New York politics, and you didn't forget her any more than you were going to forget Ed Koch. So that's fascinating. And is there any field, maybe not political science or history, where she remained remembered correctly? Is there any sort of deviation within the fields of who does get her a little more right?
She's always mentioned, right? I think it's important to know, of course she's mentioned, but she's mentioned in a peripheral framework, right? She's mentioned her name, she's a first, she's always going to be mentioned in that kind of framing. But as a significant interrogation, there continues to be, those of us who do this work, a way in which we insert her not only into intellectual political history, but a larger public discourse. And so I think that, you know, in African-American politics or Black politics, there has been a kind of focus because there haven't been that many African-American women until recently to Congress. There has just been a framework of just looking at them on the surface, and there hasn't been a significant interrogation of them. But I think what we see now is with the increased numbers, at least in political science, it's just in terms of how much quantitative data you have in terms of numbers. And the more numbers you have, the more significant people see the individuals are. I think in history, you continue to see Chisholm, but there hasn't been the interrogation that we would see, for example, as Coleman Young or others who were Black mayors in the 1970s. So there continues to be this kind of progression. And I think there's more, at least when I started, there wasn't anyone besides myself and maybe Barbara Winslow at that time who did work on Chisholm, I think. And then now we have Anastasia and others who, you know, are engaging in this discourse, looking at Shirley Chisholm, but also a broader discourse at looking at all of the women. The work that I do on Chisholm is not just connected just to only Chisholm, but the book is also the first kind of comparative study of Black women's politics at looking at Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan.
Anastasia, your first book, Stormy Weather, was about a completely different era. So I'm wondering what brought you to the 1960s and to Shirley Chisholm after looking at that earlier period in American political history.
I came to Shirley Chisholm from a background as a social, cultural, intellectual historian of Black women and gender. And so what had caught my attention and what I had really engaged with as I wrote Stormy Weather about Black Americans' marriages in the early 20th century was women's thought about what women should be and do. And there was such a diversity of thought among Black women on how to tackle gender divisions of labor and also simply Black women's intellectual production, period, that I grew fascinated with the general enterprise of Black women's intellectual history and also who these women were, where they were in time and space, and what their lives were like. So I got interested in biography, and I was teaching a seminar on biography. I was then at Vanderbilt University, and I wanted to teach a biography of Chisholm. And that's because my parents also knew Chisholm. They were in Massachusetts. My mother was a volunteer, was the treasurer for Chisholm for president in Massachusetts in 1972. And my father was a journalist in 1972 and covered the campaign. And that both of them went to Miami to the convention, the Democratic National Convention. And so they had told me stories as I grew up. I actually remember seeing a photograph of Chisholm with my parents, and I mistook her for my aunt. And they said, no, that's not auntie. That's Shirley Chisholm. She ran for president. Someday you can too. And so I always remembered her and was curious about her and wanted to teach about her as well as teach biography. So I went looking for that course for a text, and I couldn't find one. And so this was in 2007, and I decided I need to write one. And so that's how I came from being a social historian in the early 20th century to moving into the later 20th century. However, we tend to forget that Chisholm came from the early 20th century. She was born in 1924. So she came of age in the Great Depression, World War II, which is... those years are the years that originally captured my attention as sort of from the New Deal era. So that's how I came to her and deciding in I think it was 2007 that I went ahead and applied for a grant to explore the topic and start working on a biography.
And it's funny because we got the idea for this podcast because I was looking for a book on Shirley Chisholm and couldn't find one. So that led to, wait, why isn't there a book on Shirley Chisholm? But it turns out there's some good books on the way.
It's getting there.
Anastasia, you've written that this kind of trailblazer talk about Chisholm actually obscures her political and intellectual significance. How should we talk about Chisholm so that we capture her importance for American political thinking, American politics, feminism?
Well, I do tend to hark back to my intellectual history roots because she was... in addition to being a formidable political strategist, and we should talk about that, she was also an intellectual giant. In terms of her formulating ideas that we talk about now and use now that were not in circulation then, or that she was adapting. So, for example, everybody's talking about intersectionality now, and Black feminists have been using intersectionality for decades. It's not a new idea. It's just that the critical race theorist Kimberly Crenshaw conceptualized it 30 years ago in a way that. That we're using it to mean to put into words that we can consider multiple categories of analysis at the same time. That is race, gender, economic background, ability, age, et cetera, et cetera. So Chisholm saw that, grasped that instinctively, and produced a prodigious amount of work on the topic when she was speaking and writing. She studied at night when she was done on the floor of the New York State Assembly and Congress. She produced an amazing amount of output as a thinker. And so I think we see her face as instantly recognizable. You know, seeing as I was nodding while she was saying, oh, you see her everywhere, but nobody really engages with what she did. She produced thought and then brought it to the two legislative bodies that had never heard Black feminist thought before. And she got it into the record for the first time of the New York State Assembly or the United States Congress. So she's bringing new political ideas right to the center of political power.
Tell me a little bit about who has her archives and how the two of you are accessing her papers. Where are they? Who saved them?
Yeah. Who should go first?
Zynga, you want to take that first and then...
No, Anastasia can go. She was talking.
Okay, go ahead.
It hasn't been easy because unlike many congressmen who leave behind many cubic feet of archival material, her most well-known collection at Rutgers University is just a few cubic feet. So there is the Shirley Chisholm papers at Rutgers University that she donated herself. And so that's something, but it is far from.
I don't mean to interrupt, but why Rutgers? Why not Brooklyn? Why not something in New York?
So Ron Becker, who was directing the special collections in 2008, at the time I first went to the archives there, told me that she was there at Rutgers, New Brunswick, giving a talk, and somebody asked her if anyone had told her she had gotten secured her papers at a library, and she said no, and she said yeah, sure, she would put them there, and she did.
It's a great place. I mean, with the Center on Women in Politics and the focus that the university has had in really being pathbreaking in terms of gender studies, it's a great match. It just seems, and I'm right here. I'm three blocks away from Rutgers as we speak. I'm glad, but that's so interesting.
She didn't have an existing strong relationship with the institution by any means. So Brooklyn College is a far more logical place. And so in fact, Barbara Winslow of Brooklyn College sought to create a collection. And Zynga, how many years ago was that she started the collection?
So the project was over 15 years ago in terms of collection. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have oral histories. We also have we conduct our own oral histories for those who knew Shirley Chisholm and have come in contact with Shirley Chisholm, as well as kind of Brooklyn women's activists and organizers in Brooklyn from 1945 until present day. And currently we also have the archive that that Barbara Winslow was able to procure from Shola Lynch's wonderful documentary. So all of the interviews as well as the transcripts, and we also have archival materials in terms of photographs and others located at Brooklyn College. And in terms of her other kind of personal papers, those papers are still with her estate, even though I have been having conversations with her current estate now.
Yeah.
But her personal papers are not. I mean, what's at Rutgers, as Anastasia says, is small, and they're mainly speeches. But in terms of her personal papers, those are not located in any archive or library.
So, really, it's making. Basically, what the Shirley Chisholm Project has done is created an archive, and that it's a treasure trove of those oral histories, both from the Lynch film and others that have been assembled later have been tremendously helpful. But otherwise, it's piecing together things from newspaper articles, congressional publications. It's been a challenge. Chisholm herself wrote two memoirs, and those are both really fascinating because she has, as all memoirs do, the memories are filtered through her own perspective, and so there are some places where time collapses, some places where it stretches out a little bit. Some places where she just says something that didn't happen or was very different. Using those as sources is its own challenge, and where I've done everything I can to corroborate the details as much as possible, but that's presented its own challenge.
And it also requires to do your own kind of interviews, the oral histories that I've done for the project, as well as for my own book. Interviews of other people have been insurmountable and instrumental in terms of recreating a political history for Chisholm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I also, Zingo was so impressed that while I was searching around about you and the Shirley Chisholm Project, I found the most stunning thesis written by a student at Brooklyn College who writes a sort of, for me, it was sort of a tear-inducing thank you to you about how the project and your classes had opened up this opportunity for the student to write about Shirley Chisholm, which I thought was great. That just shows how Chisholm, if included in this wider Black intellectual history, Black political history, can not just impact the writing of books, but also our teaching and what gets passed on to students. Zinga, I know you've been researching Chisholm and also running the Shirley Chisholm Project. When you're thinking about her political legacy and how she has been portrayed and how you wish she would be portrayed, what is it, what are some of the things that you hope that either academics or the wider public should explore? Like, how should we view Chisholm's political importance?
Well, I think in many ways it requires a significant amount of nuance. I think doing all of the kind of press that I do yearly on Chisholm is really conveying the importance of policy for Chisholm. And because maybe because I'm a political scientist by training, as well as someone who worked on the ground in politics, it's important that we don't kind of, as I continue to say, disremember, but we can't kind of detract Chisholm away from the policies and the politics of her life. And so it's important to insert her discussions around everything from immigration to police brutality to looking at the prison industrial complex, and even in this current moment, as well as the ways in which she defined and redefined Black feminism to be expansive and broad. And So it's important for me that academics engage in the kind of politics of Chisholm, but also the intricacies that we namely don't talk about when we talk about African-American women in politics. The humanity, the mentorship, the engagement of Shirley Chisholm that she had with so many men and women to kind of transform American politics. And it doesn't solely revolve around her running for the presidency in 1972, that we in many ways engage in how she reimagined American politics, but also how she reimagined the world. That her ideas, her expansive ideas, were not limited to the United States, that she cared about the African diaspora, that she cared about Africa, that she also had policies around climate control. So I think it's important for us to have a larger understanding of her politics that get us to larger and more general discussions of the ways in which we transform the American political discourse that we're even in right now. And so that's what I would hope that academics would also align themselves to and not be fixated at that we've talked about previously is in terms of her just being a first, that she was way more than that. And that we also engage in the woman who loved to dance and loved to laugh and that mentored people that, you know, at times would be her political foes, that she has a totality of who she was and the life that she lived.
It's funny that you mention this in this way because I interviewed Charisse Burden-Stelly for her biography on W.E.B. Du Bois, and I was preparing your podcast and reading that biography at the same time. There are so many similarities between the two of them, the depth of the intellectual engagement, the interest in the world, the concern not just with one way of understanding American politics, but broadening it, and also the quality of relationships. One of the things that Burden-Stelly does in this particular biography is really emphasize how Du Bois, he engaged personally with people, professionally with people, he mentored, and he invested all of this energy and intellect in these relationships that then had this remarkable intellectual and political effect. And honestly, it really, as I read what you have all, both have written and this at the same time, it really seemed like she had a lot of similarities there. And so it really does seem like she is a figure that needs to be thought of as more than this first. Period. So I just, yeah. I was so struck by it.
And I think it's so great because at the Shirley Chisholm Project, I've literally have interviewed people who no one would know, you know, they're not people of, some people are not of kind of political or name or, you know, they're not well known. But I mean, the average citizen, the average resident of Brooklyn, some of them will talk about the ways in which they engage Shirley Chisholm and the ways in which she helped them, you know, through their daily lives. So while, you know, you will have luminaries like Gloria Steinem and others, you know, who are still living, who have memories of Shirley Chisholm, and of course they have great, you know, had relationships with her, but also the everyday people who had relationships with her are also insightful in understanding what made her tick and why she considered herself to be a people's candidate, more so than any kind of slogan that can be used to describe her politics and who she was.
My students made me promise to ask this question of the two of you. What did you think of her portrayal in Mrs. America? My students were so taken with this series. For me, it was shocking because because I think of Shirley Chisholm as this very, very diminutive woman who packed a punch. And so visually, it was really hard for me. But they had never seen a picture of Shirley Chisholm. It didn't bother them. But I'm wondering about the substance of the portrayal and how you felt about it.
Well, I have to tell you that I've been in the last stages. I actually just sent the manuscript off to the press. I've been in the last stages of writing it, and I did not want that portrayal to interfere with my own mental image, and I did not watch it for that purpose. So I was very deliberate not to watch it. So I will have to defer.
Well, you don't have to defer to me, because in terms of boycotting, because I've actually interviewed some people who really have a significant problem with the show, the series. I have not watched it either.
So, well, there's that too.
So, and because of, and I think it is right in terms of, you know, I get asked to, and I'm working on two major film projects on Chisholm as well. I think there is an effort. I think this is documented. I know Gloria Steinem has written, at least in the New York Times or the Washington Post, I think it's the Times, but there have been really blatant kind of discrepancies in terms of the lack of engaging historians when you write these pieces. I will say that.
Yes.
And I know of the personal people who've asked people, and they I don't know if the writers were very adept in terms of engaging. I know I wasn't engaged. I don't, it's, you know, and Barbara wasn't either.
Nobody asked me.
I think
that's a bad sign.
That's not a great sign. And so I don't know. I really don't have an opinion on that, but I do have an issue with people who are writing, who are doing these kind of works and not engaging the history in a certain way. So, I mean, I'm excited that people are interested in Chisholm by seeing her, but I continue to say, if you want to see, I guess, a better depiction, is really Shola's documentary that has a better framing of Chisholm.
Well, I'll admit I did watch Mrs. America because my students said that I would love it, and I can see why they love it. It's a very, very beautifully filmed, and there's a lot of detail in terms of the costume and the language and the sexism. And there's some good things in there about Shirley Chisholm, but we won't dwell on it. Let me instead follow up, Anastasia, with you about her as a political strategist. You said that we need to remember that and to emphasize that. And why is that so important?
Well, so she was one of the first people to employ a majority woman staff. In fact, her first staff was all women. And she employed a woman legislative assistant, a legislative aide, who she hired from somebody else. And she really did things in an innovative way that was not power as usual. So she didn't care necessarily who got the credit if she got done what she wanted to get done. And she was a coalition politician. So that meant that if she wanted to get something done and she wasn't on the right committee, her legislative staff would work with other members of Congress on other committees to get work done. She would also have interesting and odd coalitions with people you wouldn't think, colleagues you wouldn't think she would get along with. So, for example, Louise Day Hicks, who was notorious for opposing busing in Boston, and was a member of the delegation from South Boston that was vehemently opposed, supported, was seen as an ally of those white demonstrators who were really racist in their opposition to busing students to schools in the early 1970s. But on childcare, she actually had some alliances with Hicks, and on child development. So she actually worked with people who you wouldn't think would be allies. And that's not anywhere, that only came out through interviews that I did with her staff. She famously, or some would say infamously, had that hospital meeting with George Wallace after he got shot during the 1972 campaign. And people said, why would you go and meet with him? You know, he stands for everything that you oppose. And publicly, she said, well, you know, he's on the campaign trail like for, you know, for like I am, sort of a great there for the grace of God there, but for the grace of God go I, because she was physically threatened on the campaign trail. But actually, then after when she was working in 1973 and 1974 on changing minimum wage laws to cover domestic service workers, she had Wallace calling some of his colleagues in Congress from the South and convincing them to vote for her amendment to get minimum wage coverage for those workers, because he had this relationship with her. So she would deploy some of these tactics, the interpersonal tactics, and it makes it very difficult to document what it was that she did, because it's not in the hearing reports, it's not in the floor speeches, it's hard to find, but it's these informal strategies where she doesn't necessarily get the credit. But she lets other, it looks like other people get the credit, and she goes ahead and gets something done. So she, if you notice, there's not a lot of legislation with her name on it, that she actually introduced. Another example is, when she was advocating for Title I funding, in this, Elementary and Secondary Education Act renewals in the, I don't know if you remember what year this would have been, 76 or 7. She was trying to get these amendments, Title I funding restricted to school districts that were actually materially really in need, not middle-class school districts that, you know, were not as in need. Carl Perkins was the chair of education and labor, and he's from Kentucky, where I am. She had built this alliance with him, and she wasn't even on, yeah, that's right, she wasn't even on education and labor anymore. She had moved to the rules committee. But she was working that with him and introduced an amendment to the bill to keep that funding in truly needy school districts, so that she could get her objectives accomplished through her alliance with an unlikely ally. So it's those kinds of strategies, her willingness to kind of cross all sorts of lines, that her political strategic genius emerged.
And it's such a fascinating combination of being exceptionally principled, and in order to get your principled legislation passed, you don't really care if your name is on it or who you cooperate with. It's kind of genius. And it's funny that we haven't talked about her like we talk about people like LBJ, who sort of owned the House as strategists who knew how to do a certain kind of horse trading. And this is a very different, very, very her version of this, which is not hyper-masculine. It's her own. And it's interesting that we don't talk about her as a great political strategist in the House.
Yeah, in fact, she got all sorts of grief from her home district. Well, certain people in her home district, there was always somebody looking to take the crown of controlling Brooklyn politics from her, including Major Owens in the late 70s, early 80s. So they would say, well, she's not really doing anything out up there in Washington. And it's true, you know, it's hard to sort of show what it is. And she would brag about, well, I got these grants. But how do you explain that, you know, this bill wouldn't have passed except for you, if it wasn't for you, but your name's nowhere on it?
But then if you look at her state, I think the best kind of testament to some of her political strategy and her genius is also looking at her state politics. I think she was way more successful in terms of passing legislation in terms of the state politics than you can see when she's in Congress. And even though she was in the New York State Assembly for a limited amount of time, you can see what her agendas were. Like, we have the SEEK program, all of the kind of educational, mm-hmm. as well as, and she did a significant portion of policies around, you know, in her home district, even when she is in the House. Like, she does do the important pork and barrel thing that people, they say they hate, but you know, she was still able to bring a significant amount of resources to Bedford-Stuyvesant, one including the Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Plaza and all of the things that happens in Fulton Street for Brooklyn natives, the Billie Holiday Theater, all of those kind of recreational things, and as well as some of the educational funding that she was able to procure for the district, are still living testaments. We have the SEEK program that is still in existence. You have students who receive that funding to go to city and state universities because of the legislation that she passed. So she's able to be effective. And then there are also limitations, right? There are always limitations in terms of her ability to be an effective spokesperson versus being an effective legislator. And some of that has to deal with her unsurmountable ideology of being unbought and unbossed. And, you know, I think later in life, when she's in Congress and doing some of the things that she did in terms of coalition building, was her own understanding, or at least coming to terms with the importance of being a legislator and in negotiating and compromising and working with individuals that, you know, would be unlikely for her to have alliances and coalitions with.
Let me ask you a question about something she used to say about herself. She used to say that people had to get used to the idea that someone other than a white man could be president. And I'm wondering, for both of you, what is it about Shirley Chisholm or the 1972 election that matters for us understanding this particular contemporary moment in the United States, the upcoming elections, the presidential and the down ballot elections, the narratives around Senator Harris, the narratives around the national protest movement? What does Chisholm give us to understand those events in a richer and more nuanced way?
I think what's important in this kind of historical context is more about the substance and substantive representation than it is about the symbolic representation of having a woman or having an African American or having a Black woman in position. Chisholm, when she runs in 72, and everyone wants to say she was a failure, and I continue to tell people, even in 2020, you didn't have a woman or an African-American cross that stage at convention. And Shirley Chisholm did that in 1972. And so to me, that is indeed an accomplishment and a winning strategy of her deliberate decision to make it to convention, regardless of the animosity that she really received from the Democratic Party and the non-support. But the importance, I think, for her 72 campaign is really about us not making those connections, but making the connection that Chisholm is creating a coalition, is the same coalition that we're able to see Barack Obama really win the presidency. And so if we look at Chisholm in 72 and the importance of her saying that we need to collectively work together as marginalized and oppressed people provides the winning strategy. And so when we look today and we look at Kamala Harris, yes, that's a great accomplishment, but Chisholm was saying that I can be president. I don't have to be vice president to go up the roles, but I can indeed, and I am indeed able to be president right now. You know, there was someone who asked her, oh, what would you do if you're asked to be vice president? And she says, actually, I can be president at this very moment. And that's why I'm running. Right. And so believe it or not. Right. And so this kind of dismissive behavior that I also want us to think for us to think about that we're overjoyed by the symbolism of Kamala. But Chisholm is not running around. I think everyone thinks she's running to be symbolic, but she's not. She's running to change the discourse and the agenda. She's leveraging herself because of her own positionality, but she's leveraging herself to talk about the issues that would not have been on the platform if it possibly was not for Shirley Chisholm, who was running in 72. And so while we're in this moment, you know, everyone is in this moment of exhortation and jubilance, you know, and it's great, but we still, I think what we're missing is really the substance of Chisholm, the platforms in that Chisholm is saying that we need to discuss for the Democratic Party. And I think in many ways, the critique of people who are on the ground in the Black Lives Movement, people who are engaging in this kind of racial reckoning around all of these issues of inequalities are not asking for, in many ways, they're demanding against the symbolism. And so to say that in 72, Chisholm is saying, don't pacify yourself with having someone who is a trailblazer, but how do we really engage in what is political power? And many ways we try to not connect Chisholm with power because she is gendered in a certain way, because she's raced in a certain way. But she is tremendously focused on how do we create political power for marginalized and oppressed people. And so when we look at this particular moment, that is a part of that legacy. And if we don't discuss that for Chisholm, then maybe something is actually we're not as advanced as we think we are in terms of our politics in 2020.
Yeah, I think Zynga put that really beautifully. And she was fond of quoting Frederick Douglass, that power concedes nothing without a demand. And that's one of my favorite quotes of hers through, you know, it's Douglass, but it's via Chisholm. And that's what guided so much of what she did. And also, it reminds me that she used to exhort people during that 72 campaign to let me be your instrument. I just want to be your instrument for change. And she was accused of all sorts of things, of being crazy and of being greedy, trying to be a power broker. And I mean, that was true in some ways. She was trying to be a power broker in terms of transferring power to people who didn't have it before, not to herself for the sake of herself, but to those who didn't have it. And that was the whole point of the campaign.
Well, I cannot wait for both of these books. And you will have to promise me, both of you individually, to come back so we can do one show on each one of them, either with me or one of the other hosts on New Books. I hope it'll be me. And because this is all what we need. Zinka, I am so, my head is spinning because I there was a tweet that the Shirley Chisholm Project put out that resonated with me, but Twitter is so short and I'm not really necessarily the best person on Twitter, so you just said it better, which is that actually Shirley Chisholm is not as helpful for understanding Kamala Harris. She's more important for understanding Black Lives Matter. That everybody wants to sort of talk about her and Harris, but that's not really the helpful analogy right now. And I think what you said about the coalition and the idea of dignity and action and having this set of policies and strategy, it really does seem that would be the more interesting piece for her. And, you know, Anastasia, I think that you're like calling attention to this, the strategic part, and the fact that we want to make that into ambition, or it's too ambitious, but really she was behaving the way all effective politicians behave and modifying it with her own style according to her own principles. She's really an astonishing figure.
Remarkable.
Thank you both so much for taking the time during teaching in a pandemic and researching in a pandemic and everything else that you're both doing. I want to encourage listeners to follow the Shirley Chisholm Project on Twitter. It's a really informative feed, and I will put up links to all of the documentaries and other incredible resources that were mentioned during the podcast. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome.